think of those kind words.
Can y'all hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Too bad. But now, we don't mind if you're sleeping while I'm talking, but if you start snoring, it's out the door. Too much disturbance. I'm Speedy Moore, marvelous alcoholic. And if you're not marvelous, it's your own fault probably. Somebody says, you can't go around being marvelous all the time. I say, what page of the big book did you find that in? And as soon as you find that, I quit being marvelous. I was going to work on awesome, but Rusty's already told me, no chance. I'm just thinking about it. So I'm going to vote the next 10 years to try to get there, but I doubt it. Anyway, this place has a kind of a special little place in my memory. This is where I went to my very first meeting. It was my dear mother. I had sent her to AA because she had a real problem. She loved that wine. And she'd drink that wine and then lay in her room for days, you know. And so I'd just check on her a couple of days. I'd open the door and say, you okay? She said, So, it was kind of bad. So finally one day I told her, if you don't do something about, now I think God had something to do with this probably. He said, the only way we're going to get Speedy Moore to AA is probably put an intuitive thought in his head about his mother. And then she'll drag his sorry self into AA. So I said, if you don't do something about that drinking, I'm going to call AA. She says, oh, no, don't do that. I said, well, I've hit a nerve here. I didn't know she had attended a meeting over Highland Group about 6 years. And she, before that, but she decided that being the Southern lady that she was just wasn't that bad, quote, unquote. How many folks you hear them say that just before they die? You know, funny thing. But anyway, the next morning, she said, I want you to call AA for me. I said, really? You know. And I called the hotline. And about 30 minutes, I got a phone call. Won't know where I lived. And I told them, and this couple came over and put her in the car and drove her on out and took off. I said, man, that AA is fast. I mean, they move on. So she started going to meetings and she started coming down here. They had a meeting on Thursday night and they had a little supper downstairs. This part wasn't here then. See, that brick wall is where it used to be. It ended right there. This has been added on. But she said, I want you to go down there some Thursday night with me meet some of those folks. I said, well, I think I need to go down and see what they're doing to her. Because she'd been sober for 3 months, which was a miracle in itself. So I decided, and I didn't know that she'd been talking to those folks, especially the men's group, that she had a real live one for them. And so I didn't know they were waiting on me, so to speak. So I came and I started meeting a couple of them, and she said, now, what you can do is go in that little room and read some magazines or something until the meeting's over. And then she came back in there a little bit later and said, the men upstairs said that you could come to their meeting and they'd like to have you in their meeting. And I said, well, okay, I want to see what it's all about anyway. So I came upstairs and sure enough, they started talking about, and I suddenly realized these guys, man, they just like me. These are my kind of people. They came around to me and I said, I'm Speedy Moore. I'm an alcoholic and It's like water right off a duck's back. Didn't bother me one bit. Matter of fact, this guy told me one time, he said, we were at the officer's club at Dollins, and on Friday they had special, they had drink night, or drinks were a quarter. And so at 5:59, from 4 to 6, happy hour, and so at 5:59, I would order 6 doubles. This guy says, you know what, you an alcoholic, aren't you? I said, certainly. What do you think alcoholics do? We drink. I mean, that's what we do. There ain't no mystery. So I never have felt like I, you know, you get so many guys that come to me and they go to say they're an alcoholic. You know, instead of just saying what they are, we have a lot of folks who are different. They don't want to say they're an alcoholic. They say, I'm duly addicted. Yeah. And I said, that's great. One of these treatment centers came in, they gave him all kind of names. And this one guy says, he was poly addicted. I said, well, that's interesting. Now, what group does she go to? I said, I might get addicted to her myself. That same guy later shot himself, 34 years old. He never would say that he was an alcoholic. I mean, alcoholic is a step up, folks. It's a whole lot better to be called alcoholic than a sorry-ass drunk. You know, it's nothing worse than a little sorry drunk following all over the place. I mean, alcoholics are smart. We think a lot. We think great thoughts, you know. And so we're a lot smarter than the average drunk. I mean, it takes a lot of moxie how to figure out how you're going to get a drink. You don't have any money. And you finally get a hold of some or write a bad check. And then you drink it, and then you swear you haven't been drinking, you know. So it takes a little moxie, a little thinking to do this. I probably didn't start off as an alcoholic for the first 5 minutes that I started drinking, but the next 10 minutes I was already there, I think. My father and my mother both were alcoholics. They did mostly drinking at the house. My grandmother, we had to move during the Depression from North Carolina to Atlanta because he'd lost his job. Lord willing, he probably had 50 jobs. He'd last about 2 weeks. And he'd get drunk and they'd fire him. But he could always get a job because he had a lot of moxie. But he just wouldn't last. So my grandmother just insisted they stay in their room. And especially, she had some of these old women in there, bridge people, that old Atlanta folks, and she didn't want anybody to know that there was drinking going on in that house. But when I was a kid, I had to go up the back steps. I never could use the front steps because she went to dirty the front of the house and I might run into one of her old friends. But anyway, this was during the Depression in the 30s and late 29. I was born, I'm old as dirt. I don't even know how I lived this long, but anyway, my birthday is 3/17/24. 84, that's me. However, I don't believe in getting old. I'm still playing golf twice a week, trying to get all that money, still. And I try to enjoy myself as much as I can. Some things are gone, but my theme song is Sweet Memories, you know. But it's not too bad. I dream a lot. Anyway, I was raised in Atlanta, and my next door was lived just up from Grant Field, and my cousin was playing with George Tech, and Coach Edgar used to give me a pass when I was about 12 years old. I could sit anywhere in the East Stands and nobody was sitting. I had that for about 4 years. My grandfather graduated from the first class at George Tech in 1891, mechanical engineering. So I have a long affair with George Tech. But anyway, there's a fraternity house right next door to us. And two or three, a couple across the street. And so we were with them, and they would always have these going away parties. And they'd be over there drinking. Now, in the meantime, I'd have to go up to the nearest bar, and then we'd get a call, and I'd have to go get my father and my brother, and I'd help, and we'd walk him home. He was one of those staggering drunks. If he was going from here to that screen over there, that he would hit both sides of his room 3 or 4 times. I mean, he was one of those movie-type staggering drunks. And I think he went into blackouts almost immediately. He just could not drink that much. And I said, well, man, I'm never going to do that. And yet, we went over to this fraternity house, and they had this blast. And so my brothers and I, there's nobody there, and they had a bunch of liquor bottles, and we started pouring it all together. You know, we didn't know any difference. And started sipping it, you know. Well, that wasn't too bad. A nice burning feeling. And I didn't even think of the fact that this is the same stuff my father was drinking. And it didn't matter. And I went to high school, we had a guy who was our star halfback, and his father owned a lounge cafe thing down here on Ponce de Leon. Flashes. I don't know if any of you have heard of that one. But anyway, they would let me have beer, and I was about 15 years old. And all I could drink. So I thought that was pretty nice. So that's kind of a little drinking I would do. And then we'd go in together. We had this Model T that we had fixed up from the Ram and Wreck Parade, and we'd chip in 50 cents a piece and get a pint of liquor, you know, and then split it between four of us while we was riding around. I was 16 then, I think. 15, 16. Anyway, World War II came along. The Japs made the mistake of invading, and we bombed Pearl Harbor. And I was 17 at the time. Next year I was 18, I joined the Air Corps. And went through training, and I discovered I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and I discovered though I had to drink to be a fighter pilot. And that was just, somebody said, we gotta go in here and have a few drinks. I said, oh, that's part of the curriculum, isn't it? So I convinced myself that drinking was part of flying, you know. And got away with it for a long time. I couldn't fly far without a little drink. Matter of fact, when we got back from a mission, they always had a drink for us. And we would save it until we got enough in our little flight. And fortunately, I had one of the guys in my flight didn't drink. I couldn't believe we had somebody that didn't drink. And so I got him to give me his liquor. And so I had twice as much as anybody else. You know. And I discovered, man, you got to have that. But if the Air Corps thought enough of what you had to have a drink after your mission, it must have been all right, you know. So, I know when I got out of service and was over in the reserve, the flight surgeon told me one time and said, well, if you don't quit that drinking, because I was flying these jets and I'd take it off and go break out of traffic and pull about 2 G's and I go, that, oh, well, look, I drank the night before. I'd go in a gray out, you know, and I'd finally suck on that oxygen and I would, all right. Yeah. But you can get away with a lot of things when you're 20 and you can't when you're 30. well, many of you know. I know I was in training down in Florida, and I was we first got our first P-51s. And so I came in from 6 o'clock, been out all night with these guys, and some gas, we were drinking, which was normal. And I got in the cockpit, and the crew chief looked at me, and he just shook his hand. And he reached in there and hit the starter switch for me, and reached out and turned the oxygen on 100%. And said, patted me on the head like that. Goodbye, because he knew he was not going to see me again. But, you know, when you're young like that, you can take off in a daze, and after I was airborne maybe 10 minutes, I wasn't too bad. I'm in pretty good shape. So I was fully trained, and we went overseas in the South Pacific, and got in. They sent us, and I thought we was going to England. We was flying missions like practicing high altitude and close support for ground troops. So we got on a train in Sarasota, Florida, and started. I thought we was going to New York to get on a boat to go to England, you know. And when we got to Atlanta, then kind of angled out and went to Nashville. I said, well, that's a long way around. And then it went to St. Louis, and I was convinced that we probably were not going to New York. And then we went through Wyoming and across and down into Sacramento. I knew we went. Anyway, we went to a few of 8 of us, special, to New Guinea. They figured that was a good place for us to start, because we could fly there and practice on the. They had the Japs sealed off on the coast, and we would run practice missions. They would build up their little homes and all, and they still had plenty of ammunition and guns. But we'd come in and take a 500-pounder and blast them away and tear everything down. And then about a week later, so we'd send another flight across there and tear it down again. Just for devilment, you know, and for practice. They were good practice. So, anyway, we ended up going to the Philippines, and then they sent us to a little island called Aishima, which is off Okinawa, 5 miles out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. A 2-by-4-mile piece of rock. Matter of fact, the Japs had tunneled under it and had hospitals and stuff, and when the Marines took it, they wouldn't come out, so they just sealed them up and just left them. And so we were flying there, and they were still there. We had three runways on that little piece of rock. We were flying. Japan was only 300 miles away. Tokyo Rose came on the air. She was good. She had good music. We used to love to hear her. She said, we were called the Black Rams. That was our squadron. We were a bunch of misfits. If you've seen pictures of us in our combat gear, which is a pair of old fatigue pants and a shirt, that was it. No insignia, no nothing. But anyway, see, I see the Black Rams are leaving the Philippines and going to Okinawa. So I guess we'll see you boys in the morning. We said, you sure will, baby. Because the next morning we were up there, because it only took an hour to get there. We take off before daylight, and we would meet the sun up there on Kyushu. Soon as the Japs found out I was there, and we took care of Nagasaki for them, they decided to quit, you know, because they didn't want any more of us, the 460. That's what we kept telling them. Anyway, when I came home from the service, and I thought I had saved myself. I had been sending my money home, and my mother and my father, I didn't know, had quit working. So they were spending my money that I was sending, $150 a month, And they were living off of that. So I thought I was going to have about $5,000 or $6,000. And I said, man, I'll buy me a new car. I'm going to be a big dog around town. I'm telling you, I'll be hard to handle. Came home, I had about $1,500. They had gone through it. So, I'm sorry, son. They thought I was going to get killed. They didn't know I was going to come back. One thing about being a fighter pilot, you usually came back whole, or you just didn't get back. Most of the guys that we lost, I mean, we lost them, period. A lot of them went, and we never did, don't know where they went, and we never practiced where they went down, but I know we was on a dive bombing over Japan, and the guy, as I was flying off his wing, and was flying through some clouds, and he came out of the clouds, he wasn't there. And the aircraft, I guess, not one of his wings off. So he went on in, but there's no way for us to recover him in any way. He was just gone. So that was one thing about being a fighter pilot. But you know, nobody I ever heard talked about getting killed. We were invincible. I mean, we had the best airplane in the world, and if we could catch a jet, and they were hiding their airplanes from us, because they knew we were going to invade, and we'd have lost probably 1 million men at least. And they would tell how many airplanes, because they had 5,000 frontline fighters hit out, plenty of ammunition. They were waiting. Atomic bomb changed their mind. So fortunately for us, atomic bomb stopped the war. But anyway, second day I was back, I was cruising down Peachtree with this girl, doing about 70, in front of old Paramount Theater, used to be there, and the police had the audacity to stop me. And I had my hero suit on, and they said, I'm sorry, we'll have to take you down, I'm going to take you down. I said, man, here I'm in my hero suit, you're going to put me in jail. Afraid that's where it's got to be. So they took me down the line, jail, but they gave me a semi-private room on the third floor. Wasn't too bad. Next day I got out $50. That's all, $50. About 6 months later, I had been invited to a Debbie Tramp party over the Piedmont Driving Club. So I'm taking everybody home, and I'm coming back home myself, and I come around Peachtree, Brookwood Station, around that curb, and some jackass had left his car about half parked, shit like that. It was dark, and I just saw it the last minute, trying to miss him. But my right front fender got his left rear, just parked him just as neat as. And I went across Peachtree Road. There used to be a service station across over there. Went through the service station into an embankment, and made the first exit for soon to be I-85. The law took me down. They got me again and took me down and gave me the same semi-private room. And that judge the next morning said, he was named Judge Arnold. He never forgot a face. He said, hadn't I seen you before? And I said, yes, sir. He said, am I going to see you again? No, sir, no way. So if I see you again in this courtroom, there's going to be some serious problems for you. So the next 19 years, I traveled every alley, back way, side streets. Somebody said, you ought to be a taxi driver. You know every street. Matter of fact, when I first came to A&M, I was taking the guys to meetings, and I usually take them 6-7 meetings, and then I turn them loose. And I said, now you know how to get there. They said, hell no. Says, every time we went, you went a different way. And I have no idea where we were. I never would be able to find it. I knew about 6 ways to get out of here to Napa. But, finally, like I said, my drinking, of course, over the years, I approved the quality of my drinking, you know, some, not much, but I got a job for two old lock washer, Lockheed, and so the first 15 years I was there, I had made quite a reputation about drinking, and I had already left the reserve because I was a civilian. So I took 12 years of active duty and 8 years in reserve of flying, and just threw away, cheep, beep, who cares? Didn't even occur to me all I had to do was make 8 more years. And they said, well, it's probably a good thing because you fly those fighter F-84s and things. And about 2 months later, when I got out, they went and put those twin-engine troop carrier outfit in there. I could have flown drunk for the next 8 years easy. It was just a kind of a dumb, alcoholics make dumb decisions. I mean, I've never seen alcoholics yet that made a great decision, something to be remembered. Most of them are pretty bad, and the consequences do that. So, I did the usual drinking that most everybody else does, until I came to Napa that night with my dear mother. I'd already been in blackouts. Every time I drank then, I went into blackouts. And so I'd get a call. I'd go out there in the carport and see if my car was there. Sometimes it was, and sometimes it wasn't. Somebody said, didn't that worry you when you go out and you can't find your car, you don't know where it is? I said, somebody always calls me and tells me. And he calls, hey, Speedy, you looking for your car? You know. And I said, well, not particular, but I noticed it was gone. He said, well, it's over at Piedmont Park at the Legion. And I said, what's it doing over there? They said, that's where we found you. And you look like you needed a ride home. Well, was they telling me I was drunk as hell, what they was telling me. So they would take me away and get my car. I don't know why it was. I don't know how I kept from getting caught again, especially driving in a blackout, not knowing where you're going or where you've been. And sometimes the car was not there, and sometimes it was. But anyway, coming here, guy says, you think you could go one day without a drink? I said, certainly. Now, like Cobb County was dry, and you had to come down to the river to get liquor. So you had to drive about 7 miles to get liquor. And so I had always said that when I leave this place, I'm going to stop by liquor store on the way back into Cobb County. So I'll have me a little drinky poo for tomorrow. Yeah. But you see, AA is a program of inconvenience. They start these meetings at 8 o'clock, and I usually start drinking at 4:47. That's when I get home and get off of work. And so sometimes 3:47. And then I'd drink to 9 o'clock, and I'd had it, you know, about as far as I could go. And because I had to get up at 5:30 to be at work at 7 o'clock. And so I would always fall into a bed about, you know, 9-ish, from what I could remember. Anyway, so here it is, you know, they wanted to talk some more, and it was like 10 o'clock before we could get away from here. I was already an hour past my pass-out time. So I said, well, I'll make up for it tomorrow. I'll go get me a drink, and man, I'll get twice as much. Well, my dear mother had been talking to some folks in Smyrna there, and they had a new meeting at this church that I was supposed to belong to, St. Jude's. said, you know, they don't need to send you. I said, well, they probably need it. You know, I was raised a Whiskeypedian, and that's what I was with. So it was the Whiskeypedian church. They said, there's a lot of people up there know you. I said, is that right? They said, so I decided I'd go with it just to see who it was who was talking about me, who knew me. And sure enough, they said, now you can't drink. That's what she told me the night before, coming down here. She said, you can't drink. I said, I can't drink. I said, I got to go from 3:45, 3:47 to 8 o'clock, and nobody drinks. I couldn't believe that. But anyway, so I went over to this church, and sure enough, his cup of, and he and I used to waste to the liquor store on Friday. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, cause of her. And I said, well, what are you doing here? He said, you know how he lies. And sure enough, they were both alcoholics. They said, well, we're glad to see you. We sure need some more good alcoholics. I didn't know that my dear mother also had another meeting scheduled for Saturday. And first thing you know, she had one for Sunday. And I couldn't, so here, first thing you know, I'd gone a week without drinking. And I said, my goodness, I can't believe that I've gone a whole week without drinking. Make a long story short, the last drink I had was the day before I came down here. And I never had another drink. That was 42 years ago. Plus, some, you know. Well, it always amazed me, guys that say, man, I don't know how you can do that. Well, it's easy. You just become a non-drinker. That's what. So I became a non-drinker. This guy says, you know, you can't be a non-drinker. I know you. You drank more liquor than 40 people around here. I said, read my lips. I'm a non-drinker. That's what I've been taught. And I became a non-drinker. And I found it very easy. And after that, I did that. It never occurred to me to even take a drink. Yeah. And I've never really been tempted. There was only one time, and I discovered, and I was told, that there'll come a day that you'll realize that you don't want to drink anymore. For sure. And that happened. About 5 years after I was sober, my youngest son decided to come down to see my older son who lived over here off of Morningside. And on the way back on Northside Drive, a guy came around the curve and hit him, he and his little bride of his, they were both 18, hit him head on and they were both killed. Now, during the funeral, this guy that I'd been drinking with all these years, he comes up to me and says, Speedy, what you need is a drink. I said, easy. Let me draw a picture for you here. Here we have these two young people laying in a casket side by side, and one of the saddest days of my whole life. And now, wouldn't I look good laying over those caskets, weeping and wailing and gnashing my teeth over what has happened to me? See, it did not happen to me. It happened to them. Not to me. And it never occurred to me to take a drink. And he had to come. He was about 3/4 drunk because he could not come there without drinking. He could not make an appearance to even come to the funeral without drinking. And another one or two did the same thing. So I knew then that whatever has happened, because I know of my own thinking, there's no way that I could have stopped drinking It's like that when I've been, the last 10 years I've been drinking every day. And all of a sudden I don't drink anymore. And he said, all you have to do, if you think you need a drink, you can ask God to help you. Now he's not going to keep you sober because that's not his job. It's not God's job to keep me and you sober. However, he will show you how that you may stay sober. And by doing simple things. That's where the AA program is designed. The AA program is designed in a simple manner for complex people. And I was one of those complex people because I was very intellectual, you see. I mean, brilliant, you see. I was over brilliant. Matter of fact, somebody told me one time, you're going to be so smart, you're going to do yourself in with your great intelligence because it'll rape all your reasoning. So I tried to dumb, I finally dumbed down, you know. And I think that's, I've never seen anybody really too dumb to get this program. But I've seen a whole lot of them that are too damn smart to get it. You know, don't try to tell me anything, I know it all already. And they don't last very long. They're always questioning, why are you doing that? I don't see why I have to do that. I was told there's some simple steps, and you just do them and try to help other people and do the things the steps say, and you just might stay sober. Maybe. Because if you try to get your intellect in there, you'd be drunken a rodeo goat tonight. So over the years, I've discovered that's true. And I've worked with hundreds of drunks, hundreds of them, and I've heard every excuse in the world that you can name. A lot of folks, when they come, most folks that come, they don't really want to stop. If there's any way they could still drink and function and not get fired, I got a son. He's lost everything he ever had, three wives, and great jobs, $80,000 a year jobs, and cars, and expense accounts, and now he's doing $8, he's lucky to get $8 an hour, and well, he somehow knows that alcohol still does something for him, because alcohol is powerful, even as we sit in this room, out on that parking lot, he's sitting out there waiting. Say, come here, I want to talk to you. I got great things in mind for you. Come here. And there's a lot of folks that listen to that. But fortunately for me, I have seen what it does to so many, and even the thought of taking a drink was removed because so many I remember working with a boy in this very room down in. He didn't want to go to the meeting. He wanted to play pool. And that's when they first got a pool table. And I said, you can't get sober playing pool. Well, if he got his job with Silver Line, he was going to be all right. I said, not if you celebrate getting that job. So, I'm not going to celebrate. He got the job, celebrated. And guess what? His last, I know I told him, I said, you don't ever know when your last drink is your last drink. Because alcohol is very subtle, and it'll take you in a minute. He was laying in the hospital over here, over Briarcliff there, and his last words were, I guess, he's 42 years old, he said, I guess I went too far. Because I already told him you can go too far, and we don't know where that is. But it's a line out there that we do not dare cross. If we do, we're goners. And all of us on borrowed time anyway. So, most of us are lucky to still be alive. Anyway, I'm glad that y'all asked me. I probably needed to ramble on. You probably didn't get a whole lot out of it. But it did good for me. And I'm glad you all stayed awake. And I'll be back to see you. Thank you much.